Learn to code, build apps, inspire the next generation.
Welcome to the Swift App School podcast, where we are empowering the next generation of app developers.
I'm Charles Long, co-founder of Swift App School.
And I'm Bob Williams, co-founder of Swift App School. All right. Well, this is our second episode. It's a cool 46 degrees here in Asheville, North Carolina. Yeah, it's starting to feel like almost winter now.
It's hard to dress.
I know. It is. Well, so today's episode, we are going to talk about a couple of different items of interest to hopefully everyone in the audience. The first will be why version control is important. Second, using comments in your code. The third will be how we built an award-winning app and the lessons we learned along the way. Fourth will be Apple is allowing self-service repair for the first time in a while.
Amazing.
So, yeah. And then we'll have something cool at the end that we won't reveal until the end. All right. So the first part of the podcast is all things code. And this is for the general listeners out there. We want to talk about an app that we started that we created back in 2010. It was our first app. It's for an educational institution. It was promoting a school. And I guess the first time we went to WWDC, we had been just sharing our files back and forth the old-fashioned way on a flash drive. So if you can imagine, you know, we have this big bloated Xcode file that we zip, and I think it was, you know, a couple gigs or something, maybe not quite, but we would zip it, and then I would share it with Charles, and this was even before AirDrop, so we just put it on a flash drive. I'd hand it to Charles, he'd put it on his, so it was back and forth like that. Then we talked to Apple engineer there at WWDC, and he said, "You guys need to get yourself to Git." Oh, it was funny. I remember he was strumming a ukulele while he was giving us this advice. So it was. I don't know. I just remember that vividly.
Yeah, it was interesting because we, like you mentioned, we have been sharing these files back and forth. I think AirDrop did exist, but it was really slow on those old devices. So you would build a portion of the app. I remember it would take like 20 minutes or so just to get the files from your computer to my computer. And it was a nightmare because if I was writing part of the data for the app and you were doing the visual part, like we didn't have a way to utilize just the changes in the source code. And I knew that version control existed, but I was like, I don't want to deal with that. So we would just, like you said, we would zip it. And it was interesting, like at 5 o'clock, it's like, oh yeah, you need to drop the code over to me. So we would start it and then you're like, oh man, I got to leave. So we had to wait.
Yeah. Or, you know, if it was like, you know, after hours or something, cause we work on this after hours, we weren't, you know, working on it during work time primarily.
At the time when we started, you had to do version control from the terminal. So you had to type in everything in order for it to work. I didn't think that both of us would be on the same page as far as like, okay, we're going to type all these commands. I think it wasn't until Apple added version control to Xcode that we actually heard from the Apple engineers at WWDC that you could do this. And so, yeah, I'm glad that he strummed the ukulele and advised us. So I think right after that, we might've started looking into some videos that explain how to use it.
I think the first version that we used was Bitbucket initially because it was free and we didn't want to have to pay for the GitHub private version. So that's what we used initially. And that worked pretty well. I mean, I know there were some kinks in the beginning, but once we kind of got it working, I remember, I think I was actually at my mother-in-law's house during Thanksgiving trying to figure out version control. We were sharing files at the time. So, yeah.
Yeah, so some people might be wondering, well, what is version control and why is that important? And like, who cares? You know, I like zip files. Well, there's a couple of things that we benefited from by researching version control. There's a couple of different technologies that you can use. And I think GitHub is at this time the number one version control software. There's a few different solutions. So there's Git and there's SVN and there's others as well. So, you know, if you're listening and you are used to version control and you're more knowledgeable than we are, I'm sure you can add others. But the main two I want to talk about are Git and SVN. And I remember as a programmer from a long time ago that there were different types of version control, but I was an independent developer, so I never had the opportunity to collaborate with anyone. And so once we dove into it, I knew that GitHub was one of the more popular solutions. So I'm just going to reference a couple of articles here that kind of explain the difference between the two. Git software is installed on a workstation. It acts as a client and a server. So every developer has a local copy of the full version of the project. So a lot of times when you're setting up Xcode or you're setting up Visual Studio or you're setting up Android Studio or any other IDE, you're going to have an opportunity when you create a new file to choose whether or not you want source control. And I feel like you should always say yes, even if you don't need it, because I've seen from my personal experience, it's really difficult to set it up after the fact. If you're a beginner, like once you get used to it and you just go all in on the terminal and type everything in, it's pretty easy to set up. But if you don't want to deal with the terminal, a lot of these IDEs that I mentioned have an option that you just click and it automatically creates it for you. So it makes it a lot cleaner to set up your code. But basically what it does is sets up a repository that keeps track of every version that you write. So every time you write code, it just creates references. And so you can go back in time in order to fix a problem or go back. And if you were writing some code and you made a mistake and it broke everything, you could go back to the previous version by clicking in the history and saying, okay, yesterday it was working, today it's broken. So you can just go back and click on yesterday's. And it actually brings up two screens where you can compare the new code versus the old code. So it's really cool because you've got this repository of like this logged history of your code. So that in itself is really cool. And so Git, as I mentioned, allows you to have client and server on the same machine. In other words, basically everything is self-contained right there. SVN has a separate server and client. The files that the developers work on are kept on a local machine, and the developer must be online working with the server to back up all those changes. So that's really the difference. I mean, most of the time, I'm not hearing a lot of people using SVN, but that doesn't mean it's not being used heavily to this point. But I just know that in the community, GitHub, there's a couple of other solutions. Bitbucket, as you mentioned, is what we used at the time. GitHub was charging money for private repositories. And so we chose Bitbucket because we didn't have any money to pay for we didn't want our code public at the time. So we decided, let's just use Bitbucket. It allows you to have private repos. The other part of that is having collaboration, because even though your repository is on your machine, that doesn't help you when you're working with another developer. So GitHub is that kind of central piece where both users can set up an account and that private repo gets pushed to the server on the GitHub side. And so then you have the advantage of being able to pull as the other developer that's collaborating. Once we figured this out, it was really cool because you could go in and sign in with your account. I could set you up as a shared member on that repository. And then on Xcode, you could hit pull and it would say, hey, these changes happened to the file. And you could see your version versus my version. And you could choose to accept or reject the changes that I made.
You also had the famous blame button.
Yeah, I was getting ready to go there. So like you could say, all right, sure, you can accept the changes. And then when you start writing code and you build it, you're like, wait a minute. It was working when I had it. Now Carl dumped code in and now it's broken. I laughed about that when Apple made that change where you can have the blame button. Yeah. I mean, I think all repositories allow you to do this and not just Apple. I think it's hilarious that you can have the blame button so you can say, hey, you're the one that messed up my code. But that's just a small, you know, explanation of how version control works. It saved us a lot of time and it saved us many times.
I mean, and it's just nice because, you know, say I had made a change to the code, Charles can see that change and just kind of decide whether or not to accept it. Even if he accepts it, he still has that old code there that he can go back to in history. So I think that's really nice to have that, because there are times when you want to go back and you don't have to store, like we were doing, a ton of different zip files, you know, that are just on your hard drive eating up space, you know. So that, I think that's really nice solution to a problem that we had early on, just because, you know, we didn't want to fool with setting it up. You know, the other thing I was thinking as you were talking, Charles, I think this is an opportunity for us in our community to, especially for our teacher assistants, to set them up for maybe, you know, when we do another camp, we could set them up with version control, teach them this, and have them, you know, using version control as we're teaching the app camp in the future, or even if it's just a tutorial that they're working on, which we have some students working on right now. I think that could be great to kind of introduce them to version control and have them working together and learning that. I mean, it's just a great skill to learn along the way.
I agree with that. And I need to make sure that I put that in our notes for the next camp. I've already had the opportunity to discuss this with one of our TAs who's working on some tutorials for us right now. I explain our story and let him know that this would be a lot easier if we had version control turned on, and I asked him if he knew what it was and if he had used it. And he said, no, I don't have it on. So in the next project, we're definitely going to turn on version control. And now that GitHub is allowing private repositories for free, we've kind of switched over to GitHub. And this happened because Microsoft announced in June of 2018 that they were acquiring GitHub for $7.5 billion in Microsoft stock. And GitHub, like I mentioned, was one of the most popular version control solutions. And there was a lot of skepticism about this decision because, you know, when large companies buy smaller companies, people get a little bit nervous about their intentions. And so there was a little bit of, you know, apprehension on developers' part to continue using it. But Microsoft has done a really good job in the last few years of purchasing and not ruining the company.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, if you look back at when they purchased Minecraft, I mean, it's still the same game that it always has been. And I think, you know, Microsoft has not really, you know, gotten in the way and messed that up. So same for GitHub. I mean, I feel like GitHub has only gotten better since Microsoft purchased it. And, you know, I don't own any Microsoft stock, so I'm somewhat independent. But, you know, I just am saying I think they did a good job with that. You know, I mean, but there are, you know, cases like Instagram being purchased by Facebook where I would say that probably was not a good thing. I mean, sure, it helped Instagram, but at the same time, you know, I don't look at Facebook the same way I look at Microsoft. So,
right. In fact, as you mentioned that Microsoft purchased Minecraft, they actually added in a cloud version. And so I see that, you know, a cloud version that can be used in education. So the Minecraft education suite has been an advantage, you know, after the Microsoft purchase. And in the same manner, GitHub is getting some major advantages. And so I go back to this point that GitHub now allows private repos for free. And the other thing is really heading to the second part of our conversation about code comments. So when we were writing our education app, this is where I really doubled down on how important writing comments are. We talked about version control a little bit and how that helped our workflow. Commenting is very important. And I know that my high school math teacher, Richard Gabriel, taught us the importance of writing good comments. And as early developers often do, we don't really care about comments because it takes extra time to write them in. And we're thinking, why do I need comments? I know what I'm doing. Well, in the real world, most developers don't work by themselves. And even if they do, 6 weeks later, you have no idea what you meant. You're writing some code and you're deep in thought and you have this, you know, workflow, or you have this solution you're trying to solve and you really got locked in. And like weeks later, if you don't look at this code often or whatever, you come back and you're like, what was I thinking? And if you don't write these comments in, then you lose track of time. And so for people that don't know what comments are, basically every programming language allows you to write code in that the IDE or compiler ignores when it creates your application. Typically, it's like two forward slashes or a forward slash and an asterisk. And so you can just write that in to help you keep track of what you were doing, a specific part of your code. More importantly, it helps the other developer who's reading your code know what's going on. So the better comments you write, the better collaboration you can have.
It's really, you know, just simplified instructions for yourself, the developer, but then also for anyone else who's looking at the code later, they're able to, you know, to see, okay, this is what the developer was thinking when they created this. This is what it's actually doing in real English, and not having to, you know, look through all the code to figure it out. So it's just a nice kind of succinct instruction for whoever's looking at this code later, whether it's the developer or, you know, someone else. The other thing I'll say about commenting that's nice is that we always teach our students is that, you know, that command /, the quick keys are great for if you want to comment out like a bunch of code that, okay, something's not working right. Let me comment out this section. And then that way we can, you know, decipher what is going on with the code and maybe if this section is causing the problem. So if you comment it out and then run and then are able to compile the app, then you're able to see, okay, this is the problem here.
Yeah, I agree. So we're talking about commenting your code. And I met with a friend a couple of weeks ago. He said, have you heard about GitHub Copilot? And I said, no, I haven't. And this is why we're talking about source control. Obviously, we have some experience with, you know, an improvement in source control. We just talked about commenting, but I brought this up because GitHub Copilot potentially could change the way that developers write code in the future. What would happen if comments became more useful and you could combine that with the power of version control? GitHub Copilot is that solution. I'm on their website right now, which is copilot.github.com. And it's basically your AI pair programmer. So essentially what happens is you can write a comment and your artificial intelligence built into GitHub Copilot automatically reads that comment and it can interpret what it means and go out to its own repository of all these public source code examples and suggest to you a block of code that would solve that problem. I'm just going to read a section here. It says, GitHub Copilot is powered by Codex, the AI system created by OpenAI. GitHub Copilot understands significantly more context than most code assistants. Basically, you can convert comments to code. You can write a comment describing the logic you want and let GitHub Copilot assemble the code for you. So what it does is it prevents you from having to go to Stack Overflow and type in a Google search and find millions of, you know, potential solutions and having to dig through them. Because on GitHub, obviously these developers are writing code and they just post it on their public GitHub page and other developers can go in and download that code. And if it works with your code, great. It just saves a lot of steps. So it autofills repetitive code. It says GitHub Copilot works great for quickly producing boilerplate and repetitive code patterns. It's better if you see it in action because it's hard to explain exactly how it works, but essentially you write in a comment and it says, oh, you want to create a web server? And it just goes out and grabs the boilerplate code for that, dumps it right in and gives you a little tag that says Copilot. So you can decide, oh yeah, that's what I want. And you can just approve it or you can deny it and it'll give you another example, I believe. But I thought that was really cool because this person on the video I was watching, he typed in a comment, it put in a block of code, he approved it. He wrote another comment, it put in a suggestion, he approved it. That saves so much time when you're developing software. And I think this is the future of where we're headed with code suggestions. And I don't think GitHub Copilot is the only one doing this, but I just thought it was interesting that this is where it's headed, that you can write code and basically spend more time creating content rather than doing a lot of research trying to figure out how to solve problems.
Yeah, that's so awesome. It's going to be such a time saver for all these developers out there. And I think it's going to help young developers too, as they're learning, you know, to be able to just kind of search something so automatic that it's a solution that they don't have to, you know, rack their brain and research for several hours like we did back in the day. But I am curious, like, when is it going to be ready for Swift or is it ready for Swift? I see JavaScript and Python and Java, but is Swift supported? Or are there some examples? Have you been able to find anything?
I haven't yet. I'm assuming it's coming at some point. They're probably using the most popular programming languages first, and then they'll add in other languages because, you know, GitHub is just a repo of lots of code from different programming languages, not one specific. So I'm assuming they built their AI to understand the more popular languages first, but Swift is definitely in the top 10. And I think it's going to come at some point in the near future. What's interesting is, you know, if you're listening and you're a developer, you would think, well, doesn't that basically do all the code writing for you? Not really. You still need to understand what you're reading. You can't just type in, I need a web server, and then it dumps in code and you're like, okay, good. No, you need to understand it, but it saves time for you having to find that, you know, snippet of code that does these tedious steps. And it doesn't replace understanding what's happening, because obviously you want to be able to connect to a specific server. So you need to understand that syntax. You need to understand the technology behind it. But it's just I just think it's a time saver that's really, really cool and shows how languages are going to advance in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, this just goes down the rabbit hole of when you talk about no code solutions. I keep seeing all these articles. Oh, yeah, there's this no code solution for this and that. I mean, you're still at an advantage if you've got developer skills. And that's what we tell our students, like, hey, you're going to be so much further ahead than your average person, average developer, if you learn these skills now. You don't necessarily have to go to college and go the traditional route of computer science. Not that we're saying don't go to college, but you can learn this stuff on your own. You can learn it in high school. You don't have to wait, and you can learn it in middle school. So that's, I just am such an advocate for learning this early, and don't start reading these articles and think, oh yeah, well, you're not going to need code in the next 5 years, so I don't need to learn this now. I don't think that's a great way of thinking.
No matter what, you're going to need to understand logic. That's for sure. Whether you have to actually write the code or just understand how to put code blocks together. And I think there's a hilarious comic. I think I might've mentioned this before, a little comic strip where the boss walks in and said, hey, I just heard a kid learn how to write an app that builds apps. And there's a, you know, the guy sitting at the desk has a surprise face. But yeah, I think that this is definitely groundbreaking when it comes to app development, and looking forward to see where it heads to in the future.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing Swift in that. That would be awesome. All right, so I guess next we want to talk about iOS development, Mac development, and we're going to kind of tell our story about the early days, you know, when we were learning on lynda.com, thanks to tutorials from Simon Allardyce. And we actually saw him at WWDC, I think the year after. We were watching all his videos, so it was kind of cool to see him. And he probably thought we were stalking him or something. But
yeah, anyway. It was like we were standing in line, right? No, yeah, we were walking to get in line, and we just saw him walk past us. And we were like, hey, Simon.
Simon. He said something like, oh, yeah, yet another group that recognizes me or something. So
yes.
It was funny. Yeah. So anyway, I had a design background. I didn't really have a coding background. So I was used to, you know, dealing with layout programs, you know, a lot of Adobe programs like InDesign, primarily in Illustrator and Photoshop. And so when we initially started working on the app and designing it, initially I tried to do everything in Interface Builder and tried to lay out, and I was struggling with just the confines that were set within Interface Builder, because they really didn't give you a lot of flexibility for a custom design. And then Charles said, well, why don't you open up InDesign and design it in InDesign? I said, oh, that's a great idea, because I know InDesign so well. This is before the days of Adobe XD, Figma, Sketch. I mean, a lot of those weren't around. I think there was maybe one prototyping app that was out there that cost, you know, $20 or something, and we didn't want to pay the money. So plus I had InDesign. So we started working on that, and all of a sudden it started coming together much more quickly than if we had decided to, you know, continue to struggle with an interface builder.
Yeah. And I think when you built it in InDesign, it took off the restrictions that we were dealing with as far as the tools that were given in Xcode. Xcode does great at giving beginners a template to use in order to drag in buttons and drag in the different UI elements. But when you want to create what we created, it was so custom in what we were trying to do in the interface that I felt like you were struggling. Xcode's interface builder isn't for graphic designers.
Mm-hmm.
So once you came back with the InDesign mockup, then we could learn how to like do more advanced things. We had to do a lot of workarounds in order to get Xcode to behave the way we wanted it to based off your design, but it was great. It turned out looking nicer than a stock app.
Yeah. And you know, we started with the iPad as our primary design platform. So, you know, a lot of people were doing the reverse. They start with the iPhone and then they would, you know, okay, now let's just blow it up to the iPad. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted to look really great on the iPad first. So we kind of did the opposite of what a lot of people were doing at the time. I enjoyed that process because to me, it was so much easier to go from iPad design to the iPhone because you already kind of had everything, you know, ready to go on the iPad. Then iPhone was easy. So what we did is we created a virtual tour. That was the first part of the app. It was a virtual tour for the school that we had created in Flash originally. So, you know, one thing that impressed the Apple engineers when we were there, which was, you know, actually one of the easier parts of the app, was what we had already done with the virtual tour for Flash. We had used basically Pano to VR. It turned all of our photos that we had taken into HTML file. So we started out with a Nodal Ninja. I had a Nikon camera and a fisheye lens and shot all the locations. And I think there were maybe like 10 shots per location. You know, we had an up and a down. I had to edit out the tripod so that it didn't show up in the shot. And then, you know, use Photoshop for editing and stitching, and then use Pano to VR and turn it into an HTML file. And then voila, it turned into a 360 view. Which it was funny because at the time, I think all the Apple folks thought that we were using some, you know, something like OpenGL.
Yeah, it was interesting. The 3D person we talked to was like, oh, wow, did you do that? Is that OpenGL? And we're like, no, that's CSS3.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow. So basically, CSS3 just gives you the ability to display 3D graphics in a browser. So that means Safari, Edge, Chrome, Firefox, whatever browser you're using. The more modern versions, I think around 2004 or 5 is when CSS3 3D transforms became available. I can't remember, but at that point, you didn't have to do anything special to show 3D graphics in the browser. So that's what allowed us to take that HTML file you created in Pano to VR and just, you know, we pointed right to the file and boom, there was the 3D panoramic view right there.
I think it actually worked on the old Internet Explorer as well, which we were kind of amazed that it even worked on that version. So.
Oh, yeah. I think the object of the lesson learned there was to think smarter and not harder. I know OpenGL, but I'm not advanced enough to write an entire OpenGL solution to do the panoramic view. It was nice that we were able to find a way to do a panoramic without having to write any serious code. It's like, oh, if we can create an HTML page that will show our 3D panorama, we'll just, you know, open that on the device and let it handle the 3D portion for us. So funny how you can implement solutions if you're smart and you can find, you know, some software solutions or APIs or code online that has solved these issues. You don't have to learn everything on your own.
Yeah, we could have spent a lot of time on OpenGL and learning that and researching that and actually, you know, implementing it. However, that would have probably taken about, 6 months to a year of our research time that we didn't have. And so sometimes you just have to find the shortcut. And that's what we did. And I'm glad we did that. Now, however, we probably should have stopped there and released our virtual tour app. But what we did is we, you know, as they say in the trade, there's something called scope creep. And that happened to us. And we decided, oh, no, this app has to be much more than just a virtual tour. We need news and we need this and we need books and we need everything on this app. So, yeah, we spent a whole nother year, I think, on it in our spare time.
Two years.
Okay, 2 years. That's right. Forgotten how long we spent on this, but we weren't doing it every day. So,
right. It was after hours over the period of a couple of years. But I do agree that we should have launched the app as a virtual tour. And at that point, we could have continued to make updates, which is what most people do. MVP, you know, put your product out there if it's fully functional and it's presentable. Then it's time to, you know, post it online and build that community. But instead, we spent years. It could have easily gone the wrong way and we could have gotten discouraged and given up. Because when you're working on a project that long, you're not getting everything absolutely perfect. It's easy to say, oh, well, it's, you know, we don't need to finish this, or you get discouraged. there were times when I would feel like giving up on this project and you would call me and say, hey, are we going to work on the app?
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of need each other to kind of get you through it because the same thing for me. There are times when I didn't think it would ever see the light of day. You know, you have to put yourself in that situation, put pressure on yourself because, you know, we had presented it to our board. We had told them about it. So the pressure was on for us to finish it and we didn't disappoint. So that was good that we got through it.
And at the end, I really felt really good about the project. I'm glad we finished it because that's one of the most important things about app development is finishing a product. Yep. And that's why we recommend that people put an MVP up, minimum viable product, that mm-hmm. you get something that's functional, it works, put it online, and you can continue to make iterations and improve the product. But for all the hard work we put into it, at the end, we ended up with a virtual tour app that also had some admission material, had the latest news through RSS feeds. We were scraping a website to get all that data. That was mm-hmm. quite interesting to develop. We had, you know, a media gallery. At some other episode, we'll talk about that process of building the photo gallery. We had, what was it, publications. We worked together to create the page flip effect before Apple released that. We could talk about that story at another time. But I mean, there was a lot of lessons we learned from building this app. And in the end, we won an award for its design. And that was a very proud moment for us.
Yeah. And I mean, even though we'd had the scope creep happen, I will say that if we had to do it over again, I still am glad that we did what we did because we learned so much through the process. So sometimes it's not about we won an award, but it's not really about that. It's about what you're going to learn through the process. And it taught us so much. And I think moving forward, we've learned so many lessons just through one app that we developed. All right. So Apple in the news.
Yes. So in the last episode, we talked about Apple's return to form and the things that Apple was doing that really surprised a lot of people. And Apple is surprising us yet again. So Apple announced this week self-service repair. So for people that don't know, Apple has a history of preventing repair on their devices, even going so far as to voiding your warranty or preventing devices from working after you've had a repair done. So if you weren't at an authorized Apple repair center and you replaced your screen, then you would get warnings from that point on that the device was tampered with. Also, it's very difficult if you don't have the proper tools to actually repair an Apple device, not just iPhones and iPad, but even the laptops. And iFixit are one of the companies or one of the organizations that has for years beat the drums for right for repair. And they've been very critical of Apple. I mean, it's one thing to make your device difficult to take apart and repair, but it's another thing to actually prohibit people from using the device when it has been repaired. And so, like I mentioned, Apple this week announced that they were going to allow you to repair your own devices. And not only that, they're making service manuals available. They're offering service parts to customers. So obviously they're going to sell these. The question is going to be whether or not the pricing is going to be reasonable or not. But I mean,
that's so awesome.
To allow this, something's happening at Apple. They are listening. Yeah, for the last two years. This has been like, wow, I'm really surprised.
Well, they're going back to their roots. Cause I mean, you remember the early days of the iMac when you could crack it open and you could, you know, take out your RAM and do all that and do the work yourself. And you didn't have to necessarily, I mean, now some people would, but I remember buying that book or either getting it from the library, the Sad Mac Bombs and Other Disasters, and doing, and remember that book, that
I don't think I ever read that.
Yeah. Anyway, it would tell you pretty much everything you could do to make your Mac a better Mac, and you can do it all yourself. And I feel like they're going back to their roots now. And this is great, great news because it's getting ridiculous with the laptops that you're buying now and you can't do anything if anything goes wrong.
Yeah. Considering that the price is so expensive for your laptops and devices and, you know, you want to hold on to that investment for a long time. And I think Apple products are generally well-built, but they are made by humans. and humans make mistakes. And I mean, I know there's automation and all that, but basically every device has issues. So at some point you're going to have to pay for a repair. And it's nice to know that you'll be able to do that with Apple's manuals without voiding the warranty. Apple's also offering tools for the proper repair of your device. So, I mean, they're going all in. It's not just that they're allowing you to repair it. They're giving you the resources you need. So now you're not going to get those errors when you try to replace Touch ID components or whatever. This is amazing. And there's a couple of references we'll post in the notes, but I'm really excited to hear this. You know, iFixit responded and they seem to be excited about that as well. And the next question is, well, how much do the parts cost? I mean, if the parts are expensive, then, you know, it's like, come on, Apple, you did all this and now your parts are through the roof. Sometimes their pricing is definitely above what people like to pay, especially when it comes to accessories. Sometimes the devices have a hefty cost to them and Apple feels like the pricing is fair. You know, we'll have to wait and see. I think that if they reasonably price these components, then this is really going to help Apple in the public eye. There's some people that believe that Apple didn't change its policy out of the goodness of their heart, though, because it's, you know, reading this article that says the announcement follows months of growing pressure from repair activists and regulators, and its timing seems deliberate. Considering a shareholder resolution, environmental advocates filed with the company in September asking Apple to reevaluate its stance on independent repair. So there's definitely been some pressure. But again, like I said in the last episode, I feel like Apple sometimes tends to be stubborn about things and they will stand with their stance until they're pushed into a corner. But seemingly here in the last couple of years, they're walking back some of these things. And I think that just bodes well for Apple in the public eye.
You know, one thing I'll say is that Charles is not going to brag about himself and his repairability, but whenever I need something repaired, I usually go to Charles and have him help me with my Mac's repair. And so he knows all about, you know, taking apart, whether it's the latest iMac or MacBook. If the average person has the ability to repair their machine, I think that is a step in the right direction for Apple, because, you know, right now they're just making a ton of money on repairs. And it shouldn't be about only sending it to Apple.
Well, thanks for that. I have obviously spent most of my life repairing computers. But I will say, since you mentioned that a lot more people will be able to repair parts, I think this also presents an issue where you have to make sure you're not running into a jackleg, we call it. So it's like, oh, I know how to fix iPhones. And it's because they just grab the service materials and manuals and can order the parts, and they're, you know, anybody, like this one article on iFixit said, everyone is a genius. So now you'll have to be careful. I mean, I still recommend that you go to authorized Apple Center to get repairs done, or make sure the person that's working on your device has years of experience with taking apart phones or laptops or whatever, not just, you know, a fly by night person, because even though it doesn't void the warranty, you don't want to have to pay twice or three times for something to be repaired by someone who doesn't know. But I think this is actually going to help the authorized centers as well, because there's official manuals, there's official documentation that can be followed. And for people like me that I've been taking apart devices for years, I think this is going to help me have more confidence that I'm doing it properly and not just depending on iFixit or YouTube tutorials to make sure I'm doing this properly. So yeah, it's a great move for Apple.
The question is, are they going to keep the suction cup on taking the screens off, or are they going to change that?
Oh, they changed that already.
Like, oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah, I love that. That was one of the coolest innovations in my mind. And it was for, I got to say, it's probably the 2010 or 11 model iMac up through, I don't know, 2015, 16. I don't know. I'd have to look that up. But basically the screen was held on by magnets. And so to pull it off, you had to use like these two suction cups. You pop it on there and then it would just pop off, and that would expose the screws behind the clear panel. It was so elegant when you consider looking at that beautiful silver iMac and you didn't see any screws whatsoever. They hit them so well. I just thought it was cool that you put suction cups on the screen, pop it off, and you're like, oh man. And you just take the screws out from behind that and the, you know, take your parts out and replace your, you know, hard drive or whatever it is, or you were replacing. But now you definitely need a kit, so you can basically use the little plastic pieces, and you have to like warm up the screen, or you have to put the plastic piece around the edges until it pops that off, and the adhesive that's behind it, you have to buy that. And so I remember the first time I fixed an iMac, I had to actually, I pulled the iMac apart and didn't realize I needed to buy the adhesive. So I had to go on Amazon and purchase it. And you get the little strips in the mail and you can actually, you know, put them back on. They have labels on each one of the pieces, so you know where to put it, but not as simple as it used to be, but I'm glad that Apple is giving you the tools and resources you need to fix your machines now. That's cool. And it's not just the iPhone. They mentioned the M1 Macs are also going to have those same resources. So
great.
Kudos to Apple.
How about the original M1?
Probably so. I think so. I mean, the problem with the original M1 is I know that you can replace the battery, mm-hmm. but most of those parts are on one board. So, I mean, there's not a whole lot that you need. I think it's just,
so you're
you know,
telling me I should sell mine now? Is that what you mean? All right. Well, let's move on to something cool. We've known about the Apple Car and the rumors for years, but yesterday they announced that Apple's going to come out with a self-driving car by 2025. So that's kind of the news that's out there. It's still a rumor, but I think that's kind of exciting to see those rumors that are out there, because us developers know that when things like cars come out, that just opens up so many doors and so many more opportunities for development.
Yeah, I think definitely what Tesla has done for self-driving, what a lot of the other car vendors and manufacturers, I should say, are doing to kind of go all in on the self-driving initiative. It's going to be a challenge. Because of people, it's going to be difficult to have self-driving because the AI is having to figure out what other people are doing. Yep. If all the cars were self-driving, it would be like an assembly line. I think things would be pretty straightforward. But when you have people on the road, you're going to have to make intervention for any decisions made or lack of attention to the road or changes in speeds, you know, irrational decisions being made. I mean, there's so many variables. And for them to make a self-driving car that uses all sorts of sensors and radars and cameras, I'm pretty amazed at how far they've come. But that AI and the self-driving tech is pretty amazing. And then you add in, I know you talked about augmented reality. Obviously, we could talk about that and go down another rabbit hole, but being able to combine augmented reality with self-driving tech is definitely the future. And they're already, you know, I've seen Mercedes, I think Acura, a couple other car manufacturers are already incorporating small bits of this in their more expensive vehicles. So we are definitely getting closer and closer to the age where technology is infiltrating cars. I remember years ago when I started buying smart appliances for my home or smart devices in my home. And I realized that everything in the world is now smart, except the car.
Yeah.
And Tesla is the first car where, you know, it's the first modern car of the era. Mm-hmm. And a lot of cars are now becoming more affordable with these features added to them. And so I don't know what my thoughts are about Apple Car, honestly.
Yeah, I hope they wait long enough to do it the right way, which typically tends to happen with Apple. They don't release it right away, and hopefully they've been developing it for so long that it's going to just be a home run for them. But it's still a big question mark in everybody's mind.
Well, they've obviously hired away a lot of Tesla engineers. Elon has kind of stated his stance on that. Yep. And so with that and so many engineers being hired on that initiative, it's hard to deny the rumor that they're going to be creating an Apple car of some sort. I'm interested in seeing what it's going to look like. I know that it probably will have that iconic Apple look. I'm encouraged that the Tesla Cybertruck went all out with their design. So I don't feel quite as, I don't think the Apple car is going to be quite as extravagant or out there as the Tesla Cybertruck was, but I think they'll definitely try to make it futuristic.
Yeah. Did you see with the Cybertruck, there's like so many pre-orders already I think, you know, millions of pre-orders.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't have any intention of buying the Cybertruck. I would love a Tesla, but if I'm ever able to purchase a Tesla, I feel like the Apple car will come out right after that. And if I like it, then of course I'm going to be a fanboy and want to buy an Apple car. I can see my wife now.
Well, you know, that, I mean, you're just talking about just self-driving cars in general. I think you're going to have insurance companies get involved. And so it's going to be really hard to be your own driver probably in the next 10 years once these self-driving cars are out there, because your insurance rates are going to go down so much if you have one. So you know that it's going to be a time when we're going to, maybe 10 years from now, we're going to see somebody like actually driving and say, hey, there's a rogue driver out there. You know? They don't have self-driving. That's so dangerous.
Well, I feel like insurance will go down if people don't get bitter about it. I can see people trying to intentionally do something to self-driving cars, and then it might make insurance rates go up if you've got one and you're using it. I don't know. I
mean, maybe in the early days, but I do think insurance companies are going to drive this.
Pun intended.
Pun intended. They're going to drive this moving forward.
I can see that, because insurance companies will say, oh, you're driving a manual car. Yeah, your insurance is going to be a lot higher. It's more, you know, the other car, the self-driving cars are safer, and then you have a lower insurance rate based on that. I can definitely see that coming at some point in the future.
Yeah. And then maybe if you have a teenage driver like I do, the rates will be lower than they are.
Yeah, right now they're astronomical, because our insurance has definitely gone up since my daughter started driving.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Swift App School podcast.
You can always find us online at swiftappschool.com, and we're also on social media at Swift App School on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Bye, y'all.
Goodbye. We'll be right back.